Okay, well, Daniel, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I grew up in upstate New York, and we used to have cold weather, but this is, you know, something new for me. And I think it brings out the best in me to, you know, have to spend a week out here, you know, to kind of decompress from all that sunny weather we've been having in California. So you want to try to. So what I'd like to do is tell those of you who are not in the field of quantum condensed matter physics a little bit about some of the exciting things which are going on in that field. And the operative term here, and I think it's appropriate for Perimeter Institute, is quantum. And so what I want to tell you about are electrons inside crystalline solids and their intrinsically quantum mechanical nature. I want to tell you a little bit about the quantum phases that one can have for electrons inside solids, in particular metals and insulators, and introduce the concept of a Mott insulator, which is something which is playing a very central role in things that our community has been thinking about in the last 10 or 15 years. And then I want to turn to what I'm calling here a quantum tapestry, which is a quantum spin liquid. It's an exotic, intricately organized, dynamical arrangement of the electron spins in some crystalline solids. And in order to try to discern the precise entanglement of those spins, in fact, we want to use the notion of quantum entanglement, which is something that perhaps some of you have heard a lot about. And as we shall see, quantum entanglement plays a very important role in particularly in numerical simulations in trying to pull out the essential physics of the phases that we're going to be interested in particularly these quantum spin liquid phases. Okay, so my collaborators, and let me in particular point out the guy in the lower right corner. Who else? Jim Garrison and Ryan Mishmash are graduate students at UCSB. And Matt Block was a former graduate student. And then Donna Shang's at Cal State Northridge. And Leszek Mocernich, some of you know, is at Caltech. And I'm the cheerleader. And these guys did the work. Okay, crystals. Well, as you all know, crystals are made from many, many atoms. And they arrange themselves, at least in clean crystals, in a periodic arrangement. And of course, there's many, many different arrangements you can put those atoms into. And there's many, many different types of atoms. So there's many, many different crystals. And inside each crystal, one has a different little universe going on. And that universe is the universe of electrons. And it's a universe where quantum mechanics holds sway. And the reason for that is why quantum, is really a question of energy scales. So the typical spacing between atoms, as you know, is a few angstroms, let's say 3 angstroms. And we can ask, what's the typical kinetic energy for an outer shell electron in one of those atoms, which maybe is hopping from atom to atom? And we can estimate the kinetic energy as just p squared over 2m, put for the momentum h bar divided by 3 angstroms, and one gets about 10,000 degrees Kelvin. So this is a large energy scale. It's much larger than, of course, room temperature at 300 Kelvin. Likewise, the interaction between electrons, just the 1/r interactions at 3 angstroms apart, the Coulomb energy, that's also about 10,000 degrees Kelvin. So both the kinetic energy and the Coulomb energy, which are the characteristic energy scales, are much larger than another characteristic energy scale, which is room temperature, which is where one, of course, is mostly operating. And so because the quantum energy scale of the electrons is so high, the quantum dynamics, electrons are always quantum mechanical, highly quantum mechanical. And this is an extremely challenging problem, really, to try to understand what the electrons are doing in crystalline solids, because why? The electrons are particles and waves, or both, one or the other. There's, of course, many, many electrons, 10 to the 23 electrons. The electrons are interacting. They interact with a pretty strong Coulomb interaction. And to make things richer and actually more interesting, the electrons have spin. So, you know, what's the conceit that physicists have, that condensed matter physicists have, really, that allows them to make progress in figuring out some of the physics which is going on in such a complicated many-body quantum mechanical system? And really what it is, it's a separation of energy scales. And it's the same thing that particle physicists use as well, that one has a huge separation of energy scales between the different masses of different particles, and let's say the Planck scale and the TeV scale. We don't have quite that many decades, but we do have a number of decades. So the characteristic energies we've already seen for electron kinetic energy and Coulomb energy are of order 10,000 degrees Kelvin. One can imagine cooling down, or in the aromatization group parlance, coming down in energy, looking on longer scales, down to room temperature at 300 Kelvin or so. Then we, of course, can go into the lab and cool things much below room temperature, down to a Kelvin, a tenth of a Kelvin, and sometimes even lower than that. And what we're going to be primarily focusing on here is what we'll call zero temperature quantum phases. It's really the nature of the quantum ground state of the electrons inside crystalline solids. And the simplicity then is coming from a separation of energy scales. And moreover, it's coming from the fact that in a classical system at zero temperature, things stop moving. And in a quantum system in the ground state, things are much simpler. The ground state is much simpler than high energy excited states. And this is what gives us some hope in trying to understand various quantum phases that we might have in the systems of interest. The other thing which is going for us is the Pauli exclusion principle, the fact that two electrons cannot be at the same place if they're the same spin. And that really keeps the electrons apart and kind of is a sort of a cheap way to get in a bit of repulsive interactions that are there through the Coulomb forces. And so it's really these two simplicities that we're looking at low energies. And so the randomness or the entropy is small. And we are taking advantage of the Pauli exclusion. These things together has enabled the standard paradigm of the electron, the quantum theory of electrons and solids, which basically categorizes two phases, which are very important, metals and insulators. This is Lev Landau, of course, the famous Russian physicist, who, building on earlier work by Sommerfeld, who appreciated the fact that if you have a finite density of electrons, one has to, in a translationally invariant system, one has to figure out that there are plane wave eigenstates and start filling up energy levels, just as one does in an atom, out to the Fermi momentum to make a filled Fermi C. And Landau made really heuristic arguments that the interactions between the electrons, or between the fermions, although they're actually quite strong, they can be subsumed into a few effective parameters, like an effective mass, for example. And so in some sense, the electrons inside a metal do their own thing, at least at low temperatures, well below, let's say, the Fermi energy, or well below, certainly room temperature. An electron in a metal can move many times its wavelength before scattering off another electron. So in some sense, in a metal, electrons do their own thing. And that's what makes them relatively simple. But what about the periodic potential from the ions? And so Felix Bloch realized that the Schrödinger equation for a particle in a periodic potential doesn't have plane wave eigenstate solutions, but has Bloch states, which are, I'd like to think of as glorified plane waves. And the important thing, of course, about Bloch states is that they don't exist at all energies. There are allowed bands of energy and energy regions where there are no states, the band gaps. And of course, the difference between the so-called band insulators and the metals is whether or not the highest energy band is completely filled or isn't. So in a conventional band insulator, the highest energy band is completely filled, and there's an energy gap separating sometimes called the conduction band from the valence band. And if that energy is big, and it can be, an electron volt, for example, or even bigger, then the material is going to behave as an insulator, and the electrons are not going to be able to move around. On the other hand, if the highest energy band is partially filled, then the electrons can move around in the available states and lead to metallic conduction. Oops, excuse me. And so there's a basic rule of thumb which works for many, many different materials, which is that if you have an odd number of electrons per unit cell, then you expect to have metallic behavior, because you'll have a partially filled upper band. If one has an even number of electrons per unit cell, although it's not always the case, it's often the case that one has a set of filled bands and one has insulating behavior. But it's really this the odd number of electrons per unit cell giving a metal, which is, you know, the rule of thumb that one will learn in Ashcroft and Merman, for example, an introductory solid state physics book, and which works extremely well, except when it doesn't work, okay? And it basically doesn't work half the time. I mean, if you consider the atoms inside a crystalline solid and those electrons on the outer shells of those atoms, those electrons have an atomic character. For example, they could have an S-wave character, or a P-wave character, or a D-wave character, or an F-wave character. And in the simple materials, like the simple semiconductors, or even simple metals like copper, it's the S valence electrons and the P valence electrons which are contributing to the physics, and they can move relatively easily, in principle at least, through the material. But in D or F shell electrons, it turns out the D or F shell orbitals are closer to the nucleus, and it's very difficult for the electrons in some situations to hop from one atom to another atom. So what happens in such Mott insulators is that electrons can actually just get stuck. They can say, okay, I don't want to hop from one atom to the next because there's a Coulomb repulsion repelling me from the next electron, and I'm willing to forgo the kinetic energy and just say I'm going to basically just get locked and stuck on the atom that I find myself. And these are called then Mott insulators, and this is a Sir Neville Mott. Actually, it's not Sir Neville Mott. It's the scientist from Back to the Future. I don't know if anyone has seen that movie. I think Mott actually looks a bit like that as well. What's that? Actually, I'm not sure. It may be. I don't know. whoever it is, it gives physicists a bad name, I think, that picture. But what Mott did, I think, gives physics an exciting aspect, which is realizing that one can have insulating materials even though one has an odd number of electrons per unit cell. For example, one outer shell electron per unit cell. So that's what a Mott insulator is. And the Mott insulator, what's special about it is that it's the Coulomb repulsion between the electrons which is critical in giving one the insulating behavior in the first place. And we have a sort of a caricature model that we use. It's called the Hubbin model, which I haven't really shown here, in which there are two energy scales. There's what we call the Hubbard U, which is the energy it costs to put two electrons on the same atom, and it's literally just the Coulomb repulsion between those two electrons. And then there's a typical kinetic energy scale, we call it T, which gives the kinetic energy that the electrons would like to have in order to hop from one atom to the neighboring atom. And in the limit that the bands are narrow, that the kinetic energy is small, as it is in the D or F shell atoms typically, then the Coulomb repulsion, which is usually just a fixed magnitude, dominates, and the electrons get stuck on their respective atoms. So a Mott insulator insulates, the electrons don't move, so you might have thought it's terribly boring. The electrons are just stuck and that's it. But of course the electrons have a spin, and it's the spin physics in the Mott insulator which is extremely interesting, and that's what I want to focus on. So the electrons of course have a spin a half, and the fact that there can be virtual processes where one electron, if the spin is opposite to the neighboring electron on the next atom over, if it can hop over and hop back again, that leads to what we call an exchange interaction between the spins of neighboring electrons, which is anti-ferromagnetic in sign. I mean, basically, if two electrons of opposite spin on the neighboring atoms, one can gain a kinetic energy by hopping over and hopping back again, which one wouldn't be able to do if the spins were aligned. So in Mott insulators, the sign of the interaction between neighboring spins is typically anti-ferromagnetic, and one can write down a little toy Heisenberg spin Hamiltonian, which is a SI dot SJ with a coefficient J, which is positive, so which says that if the spins are anti-parallel, it lowers the energy. And in trying to understand what the resultant spin physics is in such a Mott insulator, it goes under the a name of quantum magnetism, and that's what I want to talk about. Now, magnetism, of course, has a much older history than quantum mechanics, and it goes back, before Christ, maybe well before Christ. And remarkably, though, antiferromagnetism, which it turns out is much more common than ferromagnetism, was only discovered in 1949. It was predicted, antiferromagnetism was predicted by Louis Nail in 1930. And again, an antiferromagnet is just an anti-parallel arrangement of the spins, up, down, up, down, up, down. Now Landau, the same Lev Landau for Landau Fermi liquid theory, had some dispute with Nail. And one of the reasons was if you look at this Heisenberg spin Hamiltonian and you take J the exchange interaction negative so that there's a ferromagnetic exchange, then the exact ground state is very simple. It's just a product state, a direct product state of all the spins being up. So that's an exact eigenstate of the ferromagnet. But as I've already said, most of the time we're going to be interested in, and most of the time it's what's relevant, are anti-ferromagnetic interactions when a J is positive. And one can write down a wave function which is a direct product up here, down here. But that's not an eigenstate of the anti-ferromagnetic exchange interaction. And indeed, if we look at just two spins on two neighboring atoms, the ground state with an anti-ferromagnetic interaction between them is in a singlet, up, down, minus down, up. And so Landau realized, I think, that there was going to be a competition between singlet formation and magnetism and antiferromagnetism. And it turns out in one dimension, for a one-dimensional Heisenberg antiferromagnet, the magnetism is in some sense destroyed by a singlet formation. But in higher dimensions, and we're going to be mostly focusing on two dimensions, antiferromagnetism can win. And as I mentioned, antiferromagnetism was discovered in 1949. And it really was only possible to discover it, to see the spins which were anti-aligned with one another using neutron scattering. And it really is quite remarkable. If you just dig up dirt outside, like, you know, here I guess it's hard, you need a pickaxe. But if you could thaw out the ground and dig it up and look at the little crystallites under a fine enough microscope, in fact, in particular using neutrons, you'd find that many of those crystals are, in fact, antiferromagnetically ordered spin arrangements. So something which was very common, you know, for many, many years, but wasn't appreciated that, first of all, that it could exist and that it did exist in many, many materials. So it's a curious history. So this is order that you can get in quantum magnets. So I mentioned the antiferromagnetic order, this up, down, up, down, up, down spin arrangement. But one can also get other types of order. So for example, two electrons in neighboring sites can form a singlet. That's this purple ellipse. And those singlet bonds can, or valence bonds, as a chemist would call them, can arrange themselves into a crystalline pattern as depicted schematically here. So the thing about order is, while it's very pretty, it's a classical concept. Order has nothing to do with quantum mechanics. It's just a regularity in a spatial pattern. So we've talked about the antiferromagnet and this valence bond crystal. And of course, and historically, one had many different and intricate ordering patterns of weave. And I've just picked a few off the internet. And of course, this is, as I said, it's a classical concept. And so what we're really interested here is something which is much more quantum mechanical than an ordered set of classical spin degrees of freedom. Now, of course, in the world of carpets and tapestries, things can get much more interesting and intricate. And there can be sort of structures on different length scales and different colors and so forth. And so what we really want to ask in this talk is, can one have an analog of these rich tapestries in the quantum context? Can we have a quantum tapestry? Or equivalently, can we have a situation where the quantum mechanical fluctuations are so strong that the antiferromagnetism that I've depicted here gives way to some sort of tapestry, some sort of liquid phase of spins of the electrons. And this is what we call a spin liquid. And that's what I want to talk about in most of this talk. So what is a spin liquid? Well, a spin liquid is easiest, and originally we're kind of defining it as what it isn't. So a spin liquid has no magnetic order, so it's not an antiferromagnet. It has no valence bond order, so it's not a valence bond. A crystal, in fact, a spin liquid is supposed to be a liquid and have no symmetry breaking, translation symmetry breaking, or any other type of order at all. So what does a spin liquid have? Well, and this is really a more modern point of view, at least for someone my age. This is a point of view that's really come in the last decade or so. as a way of thinking about spin liquids, that spin liquids have long-range entanglement. And that's really what is going to distinguish a spin liquid from one of the ordered states, such as the antiferromagnet or the valence bond crystal. So in particular, what I mean in this context here by long-range entanglement for a spin liquid is that the spin liquid wave function cannot be represented as a product of local blocks. So the antiferromagnet, essentially morally, can be taken as an upspin, direct product downspin, direct product upspin, direct product downspin. That's not quite the ground state, but the small fluctuations around that is a good depiction of the ground state. And so it's a very local concept. And there's very little entanglement in a magnetically ordered state. And even less entanglement, in fact, in a valence bond crystal, where the two electrons, which are on neighboring sites, are entangled with one another, but they're not entangled with electrons which are far away. So what was the first spin liquid? Well, the concept was originally put forward by Phil Anderson in 1973, and it goes under the name resonating valence bond state. And he really visualized, in a stroke of genius, that one could have a wave function describing valence bonds in a crystal, in a magnetic crystal, in fact, in a mod insulator, but that wave function could consist of a linear combination with amplitude C1, C2, and so forth of different configurations. So each configuration is a direct product state. So if your eigenstate was just this first term here, that would be a direct product state. But what he visualized is that the wave function was an extremely complicated linear combination of direct product states, which together make a highly entangled state, although I don't think the word entanglement would have been used in that context, certainly at that time. And so the resonating valence bond picture, and this is my first movie, and you know, hold your applause. I'm too old for PowerPoint, but there they are. So the guys are fluctuating around in a liquid state, and this is a spin liquid. And you're supposed to visualize this as a quantum mechanical superposition of all these different configurations. Each configuration is a direct product, unentangled configuration, but those configurations are summed together in a complicated way to make something which is very entangled. And this brings us to, in fact, I think, a new way of looking at least in the condensed matter community, quantum mechanical many-body systems like the electron spins in Mott insulators. And Xiaogun Wen, of course, here at the perimeter, has been one of the champions for pushing essentially a new paradigm. And so let me just bring out the difference between this new paradigm on the right, which we label here long-range entanglement, in contrast to the old paradigm, which was essentially based on notions of symmetry. And so, in fact, Lev Landau, in addition to developing Fermi liquid theory, played a big role in using symmetry to characterize phases. He developed what is called Landau theory, and there were order parameters. And in fact, Landau realized that phases of matter, such as solids or magnets, could be distinguished by symmetry. Well, Xiaogun and others realized that in quantum spin liquids and other highly entangled liquid states of many quantum mechanical degrees of freedom, you can have phases which have the identical symmetry but are nevertheless distinct from one another. So if you look at them, these two phases both look liquid. There's no obvious structure, spatial structure in them. There's no local order parameter to distinguish one from the other. But the nature of the entanglement encoded in those different wave functions can be qualitatively different. And so that's what one imagines is going on in a spin liquid. So as I said, so in the picture of symmetry breaking, phases are characterized by a local order parameter. And that's a beautiful thing. I mean, in a ferromagnet, you can tell just by looking at a piece of the material whether or not it's in the ferromagnetic state. You could look at one spin. And as a function of time, if it's more likely to be up than down, you may have to look at a few spins far away, but then you could say, you know, there's some local signature, there's a local order parameter for the magnetism. And in these long-range entangled, let's say, quantum spin liquid phases, there is no local order parameter. In order to see what's special about them, one has to look at what's happening on long-distance scales, and the entanglement in particular, long scales. And if symmetry within the Lev-Landau's scheme is explicitly broken, then different phases become indistinguishable. And in long-range entangled phases, one of the features that comes up oftentimes is that the particle excitations out of the ground state carry unusual quantum numbers, fractional charge spin or statistics. So in the RVB state, if you imagine breaking a singlet bond and giving yourself two electrons, a spin up and spin down electron, and you're supposed to imagine that the other paired electrons are fluctuating around in the spin liquid state, and one can then imagine separating those two electrons, and these separated spins are called spin-ons. And if you sort of think about it in a particular way, you can convince yourself that these spin-ons, while carrying the spin of the electron, that's spin one-half, they don't carry the charge of the electron. Now, in what sense don't they carry the charge? In the sense that on this, this little crystal that I've drawn here, there's an electron with charge one on every single site. So the electrical charge is uniform, but these two sites have the spin of the electron. Okay, so this is an example of electron fractionalization, and it's something that can occur in one class of spin liquids. Okay, so what I want to do now is talk about different classes of two-dimensional spin liquids. We're focusing on two dimensions. Partly, it turns out there's actually the possibilities for spin liquids seems to be maybe a little bit richer in two dimensions than three dimensions, but also many crystalline materials are anisotropic and consist of weakly coupled two-dimensional layers. And so one can try to classify spin liquids in different ways and parse them in different ways. But one way of doing it is separating out what are called topological spin liquids. And in a topological spin liquid, and the resonant valence bond state is an example of such a topological spin liquid, those states are gapped. So there's a ground state where these valence bonds are fluctuating around. And in order to make an excitation, you actually have to break one of those singlet bonds. And that costs a finite amount of energy. And so there's an energy gap. And then remarkably, and as we've already seen, above the gap, you can have excitations which carry fractional quantum numbers, in particular the spin-ons that I just mentioned. So they carry the spin of the electron, but not the electrical charge. And people have been talking now a lot about, and for 20 years perhaps, trying to use topological spin liquids for doing some sort of quantum computing, topological quantum computing, where one's using the topological character as a way to keep decoherence from messing things up in the computation. Okay, so topological spin liquids are very interesting. There's an awful lot known about them, and they're very robust. There's a good gap for the excitations above the ground state. But what I want to focus on, in fact, are gapless spin liquids. And so the algebraic spin liquids, they are much more fragile. If you want to think about their ground state in terms of a singlet bonds, as I've done here, you have to think about having configurations where those singlet pairs of singlet bonds are longer. And in fact, you have singlet bonds kind of on all length scales with some distribution. And sometimes these algebraic spin liquids afford a description in terms of an emergent fermionic degree of freedom, which can have, in fact, a Dirac or relativistic dispersion, which then gives distinctive Pauli singularities in the spin-spin correlation functions at points in momentum space, for example, right at this Dirac point. The most complicated and, in some ways, the most interesting class of two-dimensional spin liquids are spin liquids that I'm terming here spin Bose metals. Spin Bose metals are stable gapless phases with many, many, many gapless degrees of freedom. In fact, if one thinks about describing a spin Bose metal in terms of these spin-ons, which I was talking about before, one should think about having a Fermi surface of spin-ons. So a spin Bose metal is a bit analogous to the metallic state of electrons or fermions, but it's made of spins. And it shares the feature with a Fermi liquid that the correlation functions, in this case spin correlation functions, are singular along surfaces in momentum space. And so there's many, many low-lying excitations living near these surfaces. Okay, so how do we characterize this type of these quantum spin liquids beyond telling one that there's a gap and or gapless excitations and looking at where the gapless excitations exist in momentum space? How do we characterize the disorder? There's no order in these spin liquids, so one's trying to characterize disorder. And the way one characterizes disorder in classical systems is with entropy. High entropy is a lot of disorder. And so what we can use in the quantum context is a quantum analog of entropy, which is called entanglement entropy. And I'll just tell you a little bit about that. So probably reminding you, many of you that have seen this, but let me just first consider thermal entropy. So imagine you have a two-dimensional system, an L by L system, described in by a density matrix in a canonical ensemble. And you can calculate the entropy in principle by just taking trace of rho log rho. And the entropy is generically extensive. It grows with the volume of the system. In this case, in two dimensions, it grows with as L squared. And then in a classical system, the entropy, and that's the third law of thermodynamics, vanishes as you go towards zero temperature. And in a quantum system, if the ground state is in a pure state and there's just a non-extensive set of ground states, then the entropy as defined here, trace of rho log rho, is just equal to zero. So as in a classical system, a quantum ground state has zero entropy because there's only one state that one has. But what about quantum entropy or entanglement entropy? Well, here it's really a beautiful idea. And what one does is one takes the system and does a bipartition, dividing it into region A and region B. And one traces out the degrees of freedom in region B to get what's called the reduced density matrix in region A. And this is the reduced density matrix in region A basically contains all of the information that you have accessible to you if you live in that region but don't have any access to region B. You don't have full access. If you are confined to region A, you don't have full information about the quantum state. So even if you're in a pure quantum state, the reduced density matrix rho sub A is not a pure state density matrix. It looks like a mixed state. And so one can, in fact, then take the entropy from the reduced density matrix by tracing over the degrees of freedom now in A, trace A rho A log rho A, to get the entanglement entropy. And that entanglement entropy tells one how the quantum mechanical degrees of freedom are entangled between those two subsystems. So the simple example, which many of you have probably seen, if you put one spin a half in region A and one spin a half in region B, if those two spins are in a direct product state, spin A is up and spin B is down, then the entanglement entropy is zero. That is, by looking in region A, you have full information about the spin in region A, because it's a direct product, and so it doesn't matter what's done with the spin in region B. On the other hand, if these two spins in A and B are in a singlet state, for example, up, down, minus, down, up, then if you live in region A, you have essentially no information about the nature of your spin. The lack of information means there's a high entropy, and it's really the entanglement entropy which is high, and that's equal to log 2. That's really representing the lack of local information. And that's the key thing about a quantum mechanical system, which is entangled between different places. If you look locally, you have very little information about the global properties of the system. Or in fact, you have very little local information about the local properties of the system. So the person in region A, if this is in a spin singlet, doesn't really have anything definite information that he or she can say about what the spin in region A is doing. What direction is it pointing, for example? Now, in the context of many body states, like this valence bond crystal, if you draw, let's say, a cut through the system, and it cuts through many singlet bonds along a length L, you find that or would guess that, and indeed this is the case, that the entanglement entropy is linear in the dimension of the boundary separating A from B. And in two dimensions, that's an area. The boundary is an area. And so we call this an area law. And in fact, many ground states, their entanglement entropy, many ground states of quantum mechanical systems, of local quantum mechanical systems, their entanglement entropy grows with the area. And this should be contrasted with thermal entropy, which scales with the volume. So ground states are much simpler in some sense because of the there's quite a bit of locality in a typical ground state. Entanglement entropy, it turns out, serves as a beautiful diagnostic for spin liquids. And let me just tell you a little bit about that. So in the topological spin liquids that I was talking about, which have a gap and which have fractionalized excitations above the gap, while they have an entanglement entropy which goes as an area law, there is a piece which actually is a minus sign, which is an indicator of the essentially the non-local topological order which is encoded in that system. And it's really in a topologically ordered state, in one of these topological spin liquids, you actually, there are certain conservation laws you have, like in the fractional quantum Hall effect. If you have a one-third Laughlin quasiparticle sitting in region A, you know that there are two other one-third Laughlin quasiparticles sitting in region B. So actually, you have some information about region B that is actually non-local, and that's why this is minus gamma. And this gamma is a dimensionless quantity which characterizes the nature of this topological spin liquid or this topological phase. The spin Bose-Mennel phase that I was talking about, which you could think of as having this spin-on Fermi C, they actually have a violation of the area law. And this is indicative of a lot of entanglement. The entanglement grows as L log L, so there's a multiplicative log. So the spin Bose-Mennels are very entangled. And they're as entangled as the electrons are in a metallic system. So where do we find spin liquids? I've sort of talked a little bit about what spin liquids are. They have this long-range entanglement. There's different types of spin liquids. The entanglement entropy gives us a diagnostic or a characterization of these spin liquids. Where do we find them? Well, we want to destroy the order, the anti-ferromagnetic order, so it's good having a low spin. Spin a half is good. It's good having frustrated interactions. If you have three anti-ferromagnetically coupled spins around a triangle, there's what's called frustration. This red spin doesn't know what to do. It's also good to have spins sitting on lattices which have low coordination number, so there aren't many neighboring spins, so the things are rather floppy. And it turns out one of the ideal experimental lattices is the so-called Kagame lattice, which is a lattice of corner-sharing triangles. And there are various Kagame crystals that one has found in nature, and apparently this jarosite is on the moon too. But Herbert Smithite, I'm not sure where this name came from exactly, but it's probably something to do with the name of the guy. I mean, I guess he was British, but Herbert Smithite is a nice crystalline material because it's a spin a half system of moments, spin a half electron moments living on the sites of the Kagame lattice. And so the simplest model, which is probably probably a little too simplified for Herbert Smithite, would be to write down a Hamiltonian in which just the nearest neighbor spins on the Kagame lattice are antiferromagnetically coupled with one another. Well, how do we detect whether we have a spin liquid in such a simple model? This is a simple model. Well, how do we solve our simple models, like the Heisenberg model? Well, it's actually impossible, and this is really what keeps all of us in business. Analytically, it really is impossible, except in some one-dimensional cases. Numerically, how about? Well, it turns out numerically, really in the last 10 or 15 years, at least as I see it, the computer is starting to play a really important and almost central role in trying to quite literally disentangle the behavior of interacting many-body quantum mechanical systems. And I would say 20 years ago, the computer didn't really help that much. There were exceptions, like in the fractional quantum Hall effect, things that Duncan was doing. But largely, particularly in systems which are gapless, the computers really weren't powerful enough. And to some extent, some of the algorithms weren't developed enough. But things have really taken off. And I think now the computer is just playing an absolutely central role in computing the properties of quantum mechanical systems using a silicon classical computer. What are the techniques? Exact diagonalization, you literally just take the Hamiltonian, write it as a matrix and try to diagonalize it, and that's very limited, although there are situations when that actually works rather well. But in terms of spins, you can maybe get up to 40 spins, 40 sites. That's not so many. Quantum Monte Carlo is a great technique unless the model you're looking at has what's called a sign problem, and then it's very, very difficult to make progress. If you don't have a sign problem, quantum Monte Carlo, you can really, knock the crap out of the problem and really, nail things down. So it's very powerful when it works. Variational wave functions, where you just write down a wave function, you guess a wave function for some Hamiltonian, and you might try to look on the computer whether or not that wave function has a low energy. The problem with variational wave functions is, you put in. You get out what you put in. If you put in a good guess, you get out a good guess. So they're very biased. But then there's this remarkable progress really over the last 10, 15 years coming out of originally Steve White's work on a density matrix normalization group and their descendants, Guifre, Vidal, and others have looked at sort of tensor analogs of the matrix product states which are underlying the density matrix normalization group and scale invariant analogs. And these new methods, the reason I think they work well when they work, and they often do work, is that they are low entanglement techniques. And I've already said that the ground states of quantum systems are actually not very entangled. And so if you're focusing on trying to understand the properties of the ground states, and your technique is good at looking at low entanglement states, you might have a chance in getting computationally accessing the ground states of the Hamiltonians you might be interested in. So there's a very nice example of this recently using density matrix normalization group. There were two groups, David Hughes and Hongchen Jiang, and Zhengheng Wang is here. And I don't think he did the numerics, but actually in this problem, the clever thing was knowing what to plot and how to plot the numerics. And what one was looking for here was evidence for a topological spin liquid. And remember I said that the entanglement entropy in a topological spin liquid has this linear area law piece minus a constant gamma. And they were able to plot the entropy as a function of L versus L and extrapolate back and pick up an offset coming out of the DMRG, which was very close to log 2. And log 2, it turns out, is the expected value for the reduction in the entanglement entropy for what's called a Z2 spin liquid. It's the sort of simplest possible imaginable spin liquid. And it seems like, and this is, I still think a little bit controversial, that this very, very simple Hamiltonian of just spins 1/2 antifermanently coupled living on the Kagame lattice might actually then have a ground state, which is in one of these topological spin liquids. Well, where else to look for spin liquids? The other place to look is, it turns out, looking close to a metal. In a metal, the electrons can move around, and when the electrons can move, it's very hard for their spins to anti-ferromagnetically align with one another. So if one considers a phase diagram in this, in terms of these two parameters I introduced before, U, the Hubbard interaction between two electrons, and T, the kinetic energy, so there's a one-dimensional phase diagram. When U is very small, one has a metal. When U dominates, one has the Mott insulators that I was talking about. And somewhere in between, there's what's called the Mott transition. And if one has a weak Mott insulator just living on the insulating side of the Mott transition, then one expects that the electrons, while not moving completely through the crystal like a metal, are kind of moving around enough that maybe they can scramble and disorder the antiferromagnetism that you might want to eliminate if you are interested in a spin liquid. And it turns out that there are a couple of experimental candidates for spin liquids which are perched close to a Mott transition. And there are classes of materials which are basically not crystalline materials made of atoms, they're crystals made of big molecules, of organic molecules, which stack up to form, in fact, triangular lattices and then layers of triangular lattices. I don't think I want to tell you too much about it, and there's still some certain amount of controversy about the interpretation, but the basic feature that one sees in these Mott insulators is that if you put them under pressure, they become metallic. So they're close to being metals, but they're insulators. And moreover, that they certainly have a lot of low energy spin fluctuations or low energy fluctuations. The Pauli spin susceptibility appears to approach a constant at low temperatures. The specific heat seems to be roughly linear, and at least in some of the materials, the thermal conductivity divided by temperature seems to be linear, as in a metal. So what's remarkable about these organic insulating Mott insulators is that as far as the Pauli spin susceptibility and the specific heat and thermal conductivity, they look like they're metals. They move heat around well. They have a lot of low energy excitations, but they don't move electrical charge. So it looks like a metal, smells like a metal, but is not a metal. It's an insulator. And that's because of that, it's very interesting. So, which spin liquid might we want to start exploring in the context of these organic materials, one which is perhaps has many, many low energy excitations similar to what one has in a metal? That is, which spin liquid do we want to look at to describe a weak Mott insulator? And the projection, the proposal that goes back almost 10 years now by Leszek Mocernich and Sunsik Lee, who is here, I believe, and Patrick Lee, in 2005, they suggested that maybe what one should think about is what's called a Gutzwiller projected Fermi C state. And so I'll describe this very quickly. These spin liquid wave functions I've already described, that you can think of them as a linear combination of an infinite number of terms where the valence bonds are in different configurations in each term. So that's extremely complicated. And how can one encode that wave function other than specifying these complex numbers, C1, C2, and so forth? Well, there's a beautiful trick, which is to construct a spin liquid that, in fact, resembles a metal, which is what we want to do, using a filled Fermi C. A filled Fermi C is taking a product in momentum space rather than real space. So you act on the vacuum of, let's say, electrons or fermions, and you write a product of CK dagger with K inside the Fermi C. And that's a very complicated looking wave function in real space, even though it's very simple in momentum space. However, it's not a wave function for spin degrees of freedom, because you're building a wave function for fermions, and the spins certainly are not fermions. So what the idea is here is you can construct a spin wave function by taking a wave function of a filled Fermi C for spinful fermions. And here it is. So I'm calling the fermions F up and F down inside a Fermi C. And you sum up all these real space configurations, which are very, very complicated. And in order to get a spin wave function, one just throws out all configurations except those in which there are no empty or doubly occupied sites. So this is what's called Gutzwiller projection. And you just throw, it's like saying, I'm going to take a metal, and I'll let those electrons move around, and I'll just go bam, and I'll freeze the electrons, one on every site. And the amplitude I get for doing that will be the amplitude in this spin liquid wave function. And this spin liquid wave function, which I'm calling a spin Bose metal, it turns out, perhaps not surprisingly, that it has singularities in momentum space, rather like in a metal. So in a metal, there are excitations across the Fermi surface where you take a spin up on one side of the Fermi surface and you scatter it to become spin down on the other side of the Fermi surface, and you transfer momentum 2kF. And just in a one-dimensional free fermion, you find there's a slope discontinuity in the spin-spin correlation function at 2kF. Well, in a spin Bose metal, as we'll see, you also have singularities at some momentum, even though you have no fermions. This is for a spin model. And it's actually, the singularities are stronger than in a metal. So what is the Hamiltonian we might look at for a spin Bose metal? And it turns out what we want to do, if we want to describe a weak Mott insulator, we have to imagine expanding away from the large U limit, which to lowest order, when we expand the Hubbard model for large U over T, it gives us small t over u, it gives us the Heisenberg exchange interaction that we've been talking about a lot before. But the next order term, at order t to the fourth over u cubed, is an interaction which we call a ring exchange interaction, which basically just consists of four electrons on four sites, which just rotate by 90 degrees. They rotate clockwise or counterclockwise. That's the dynamical term that we're going to add to the Hamiltonian, and that's called a ring exchange Hamiltonian. And in some sense, that ring exchange term kind of mimics the charge fluctuations that you would have in a metal, but without actually fluctuating the charge density. It just keeps things moving around. And one can ask, then, in this ring exchange Hamiltonian, is the ground state a spin liquid? And if it is a spin liquid, could it be one of these projected Fermi C states? And how can we tell? And the way we were able to tell was to use idea that if you put a system which has a singularities on along surfaces in momentum space on a ladder on a quasi one-dimensional set of chains, you can actually see quasi one-dimensional descendant states of the two-dimensional system you might be looking at. So, for example, if you have a system which in two dimensions has singular correlations along, okay, I'm calling them Bose surfaces in momentum space, if you put that system on a, a six-leg ladder, you quantize the transverse momentum, and each of these quantized transverse momentum will hit this two-dimensional surface at a set of discrete points, which will give you a fingerprint of the two-dimensional surface as the presence of a number, in this case perhaps six, gapless one-dimensional modes. So you can access this two-dimensional spin Bose metal, in principle, by searching for quasi-one-dimensional descendant states. And this was implemented in collaboration with Donna Sheng and Lasik Motrinich, where we did the simplest thing. We took this Heisenberg antiferromagnet on a triangular strip, okay, and we added this ring exchange interaction, and Donna implemented the density matrix normalization group. We also looked at Gutzwiller wave functions, and we looked at sort of a gauge theoretic treatment that you can develop for these Gutzwiller projected states as well. And what we found, I'll just flash up quickly, is that over a rather large region of the phase diagram, that this spin Bose metal phase appears to exist. And the evidence for that came from multiple checks. But let me just show one, which is the spin-spin correlation functions. And the red points are the spin correlation functions in the this two-leg zigzag ladder. And you see singularities at different momenta. Now, I've labeled these momenta 2kf1 and 2kf2. Those labels correspond to the wave function that we constructed filling up a two-band Fermi C before doing the Gutzwiller projection. But in the spin Hamiltonian, there are no fermions, there are no Fermi surfaces or anything. But nevertheless, the singularities which emerge in the ground state of this spin model have locations in momentum space which coincide with what you would find if you took a Fermi C at that filling, basically, in the spin correlation. So we identify these singular momenta. Let me just wrap up here shortly to mention entanglement entropy. We were talking about using entanglement entropy as a diagnostic for looking at different spin liquid phases. So let's look at what one would expect on this quasi one-dimensional two-leg zigzag ladder. I guess for those of you who are in this entanglement program, Paul Fenley was telling us about the entanglement entropy in a gapless one-dimensional system, one-dimensional quantum system, grows logarithmically with the region L sub A, and where C is the central charge. And so we can use this. Now, what would we expect for this spin Bose metal phase? Well, within the Fermi C, the Gutzwiller Fermi C projection way of thinking about things, we have two bands, so that we have two sets of Fermi points. So we have spin and charge and two bands. That's four gapless modes. But then we have the Gutzwiller projection itself, which takes us down to three gapless modes. So the prediction is that we should have a central charge of three in this spin Bose metal phase. And I should emphasize that these the excitations which describe this central charge are, we presume, one-dimensional modes. They have to be one-dimensional, but they're going to have, in general, different velocities. And so the system doesn't have a conformal invariance, but nevertheless, it does have a characteristic entanglement. And so here's what's shown is the entanglement entropy as a function of a scaled distance, I guess, LA over L. And what's shown is the Heisenberg model, which has just one gapless mode and a central charge of one. And then the spin-Bose metal, this Gutzwiller-projected Fermi C state, which has a much higher slope. Look, it's much more entangled, and it makes it much more difficult to understand and to extract its properties. But quite remarkably, it has a slope which is, you know, very much consistent with the theoretical expectation of a central charge of three. So hidden in this are in this spin-Bose metal phase on this two-leg zigzag strip are sort of three gapless modes moving at different velocities and centered at different, well, they're centered at zero wave vector, I guess. And okay, so I think I will really just, since I'm basically out of time, I will just, you know, wrap up. So, so what is sort of the take-home message? The take-home message is one that's really positive, I think, which is that exotic, highly entangled quantum states are, you know, starting to be understood theoretically. We've seen that Mott insulators are one place you can look for these highly entangled quantum mechanical states, and in particular, spin liquids is examples of highly entangled quantum states in such Mott insulators. I haven't talked about doping spin liquids. But things, I think, are really opening up, both theoretically and experimentally. And, you know, so one could say the future is now, but I don't even know what that means, but so I'll say it. But I could say spin liquids have arrived. Well, you've seen them, right? So there they are. There's spin liquids, I really think, you know, 10, 15 years ago, there were leading figures in our field who didn't think spin liquids could exist in two dimensions or three dimensions. And so I think there's been a lot of progress, not only theoretically in understanding them, using ideas of topology and other ideas of entanglement entropy, but also seeing evidence experimentally and certainly in model systems. Entanglement entropy really has emerged. I mean, entanglement entropy, when I first heard that word, I don't know when it was, 15 years ago, I took the usual physicist closed-minded attitude, which is if I don't, you know, I haven't heard of something, it can't be important. And, you know, I'd say it took me 5 or 10 years before, you know, the young people that were kind of growing up with entanglement were saying, like, just pushing it in my face and saying quantum mechanics is entanglement. That's what it's about. You just, you know, get with it kind of thing. So I think, you know, for entanglement is really playing an important role, at least in theoretical quantum condensed matter physics right now. And I'm sure it will continue to play that role. Quantum simulations, I talked about, you know, the role that the computer is playing, and it's more than just using a fast computer, it's thinking of clever algorithms. And those algorithms are, you know, where much of the physics is. You have to really understand the nature of the kind of entanglement that can exist in these states, and in some sense try to devise computational approaches which look for or build in those types of entanglement. So experiments have arrived. I mean, there aren't that many experiments, but there's a number of them now, at least for gapless spin liquids, which seem to be at least promising. And I think that's an important aspect of this field. And I've been mostly emphasizing the theoretical side of things is to bring some of this back and really try to, confront the new materials, like these organic materials and Herbert Smithite. And certainly there's efforts going on in the community in those directions. And the really thing which is most promising to an aging guy like me is the amazing young people that are coming into quantum condensed matter physics right now. I mean, it's just, it's very, very gratifying. And, I think that there's a lot of hard problems that need solving. And as, I think a lot of those hard problems hopefully are going to be solved, sooner rather than later, please. And so, yeah, thanks. Thank you so much. I appreciate your attention.
We like to give students the first chance to ask questions. So are there any students that have questions?
Where are the brilliant young minds?
shy, I guess.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
You really are brilliant. I mean, you just have to...
So let's open to questions from everybody.
So Matthew, can you maybe say what do you think is the importance of this notion of entanglement and long-range entanglement, you know, beyond the field of spin liquids, more generally?
Well, I think it's just gives us a way to understand the you know, what makes quantum mechanics different than classical, you know, classical systems, right? I mean, it's a spooky action at a distance, and when we have many interacting quantum mechanical degrees of freedom, you know, knowing how much of that non-locality we have is, I think, you know, one of the most important characteristics. Now, the other thing I mentioned, symmetries have played an amazingly important role in physics, and they will continue to play an important role. There's no question about it. But I think it's useful to, at least has been conceptually useful for me, to separate out symmetry from entanglement. I mean, sometimes if one's looking at a quantum system, one focuses on the symmetry, and it may be important, the symmetry, but then sort of sees the symmetry and doesn't see the essence of the quantum mechanics. And I think historically that was a little bit the way it was. We had order parameters, and they were classical. I mean, you know, really we had an expectation value. Okay, they were expectation value of some quantum field operators, but they basically behaved like classical variables. And you know, we now understand, you know, why that is that the quantum state is really a direct product state. There's a real locality embedded in that in those states. So, I mean, you know, it may just be a good. I mean, entanglement is a good way to think about quantum systems, and you know, where one can take that will depend on what one can do with it, I guess. But I think it's already been useful, certainly in the computational context and in the conceptual context, and you know, in the experimental context. You know, I mean, it's easy to say, well, how do you measure entanglement? We haven't measured it and so forth. But I'm not sure that's, you know, that one can always make that criticism. I'm not sure that's, you know, don't hang on to that criticism. I think I did, you know, for a few years. And I'm not sure that was a wise thing to do. Because, you know, conceptual things are not necessarily the easiest things to measure. I mean, you can understand something that is not yet measured. I mean, and I think that's what entanglement is, a bit like that stage.
So I guess you choose your spin Bose metal on the triangular lattice for frustration. So what happens on the square lattice?
Well, it wasn't okay. So the triangular lattice is probably important, but also the ring exchange is important. And the ring exchange, it gets the electron spins moving, but in some sense it gets the electrons moving, but not moving, you know, in translationally, but getting them spinning around. Now, you could ask me what the phase diagram is for the square lattice Heisenberg model with ring exchange, and I don't know what the answer is to that. And my guess is I think there is some work on that, and you know, if you look at the two-leg ladder, it tends to, if the two-leg ladder has two sites per unit cell, and it tends to like form plaquette order, tends to form sort of a classical direct product plaquette state. This is unfortunately where things are at. I mean, we can, you know, you can ask a good question like that. You know, take a model you like and stick it on a different lattice. What do you find? Well, we don't know what we find until we look. And even when we look, unless we kind of know what we're looking for, we might not find it. I mean, but you really need some guide, as in your work with the Kagame lattice. You have to kind of know what to be looking for in order that, you know, for you to have found it. And that's, you know, so it's all a bit murky still, this connection between, you know, this Hamiltonian and this quantum phase. And I think that's, you know, that you know, building those bridges is clearly an important thing, you know, in the condensed matter community. I mean, to be able to be predictive, you know, for a given model, this is what you expect.
Excuse me. So I seem to have an impression that people have some debate or discussion about whether the older state can exist at a non-zero temperature. So my question, I don't know. So the question is the following, say, it seems like there is already experimental evidence of a spin liquid, presumably it's a Z2 spin liquid or Z2 topological order. So I wonder whether there's a paradox or there is some kind of a resolution between the understanding about this statement about topological order states only existing zero temperature or actually can go beyond non-zero temperature.
Yeah, no, so that's a really good question. I think, I mean, my understanding is that in, let's take two-dimensional topological phases of matter, the excitations, which can carry fractional quantum numbers, cost a finite amount of energy to create. And if you're at finite temperature, you will have, unless your temperature is well below the gap, but once the temperature is sort of comparable to the gap, you're going to have a fair number of thermally excited quasi-particle excitations, and those quasi-particles will move around, and then you will really, any you know, manifestations of the zero temperature topological order will be washed out. So I think in two dimensions, at least for translationally invariant systems, temperature is not good for topological phases. But you know, when it's living off exponentials, I mean, if one has an energy gap which is, you know, 10 degrees Kelvin, and one's at a temperature of 100 millikelvin, you know, one's, you know, the density of those quasiparticles is, you know, e to the, you know, the distance is e to the 100 angstroms. I mean, you know, so the hope is that if one can get topological phases with energy gaps which are big enough that one can cool, you know, by a factor of 10 or 100 below them, then one perhaps is going to be okay. I mean, in three dimensions, well, I think three dimensions things are a little bit trickier because there are some aspects of topology that I think when you have line excitations which can still exist, but the point-like particles in three dimensions, that I think they're also going to be thermally excited at finite temperature. But this, it's a good question. I mean, there have been recent ideas that if you put quench disorder, if you put enough impurities into the system, that these thermally excited quasiparticles that I was referring to, maybe they could get stuck on the impurities and not move around. And so ideas coming out of many-body localization, people have suggested that maybe one can stabilize a topological phase at finite temperature by really giving up the notion of temperature, actually. So giving up the notion of ergodicity, you know, breaking ergodicity with enough impurities. But this is a good question. I think there's a lot of things to think about along those lines. So.
Maybe a vague question and maybe a bit uninformed, so correct me if what I say doesn't sound right. But I have the impression that the idea of order parameter is still somehow a more central or more flexible concept than entanglement or entanglement entropy. That you can talk about effective Hamiltonians or actions for order parameters, and it's like opens up a whole new world way of thinking about things. Whereas entanglement entropy is an important diagnostic, but it's not, so to speak, a new kind of dynamical degree of freedom. So do you see that there's something out there still to be understood that'll provide a new kind of framework for thinking about systems where entanglement is important?
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely clear that symmetry and the notion of order parameters are not only, I mean, they're important conceptually, and they're important in, you know, most, if not, you know, many, many experimental systems. And the reason they're so observable, I think, in experimental systems is because it's something local, right? It's you can look locally and find something, then you can look at you can use a local probe, or if you have something like an antiferromagnet, which is periodic, you can scatter a wave off it, so you can detect it. I certainly agree completely that you know, symmetries and order parameters and the effective field theories which use them have, you know, and will have and will continue to play a tremendously important role in condensed matter physics, but a symmetry broken phase is not quantum mechanically entangled, right? And that at long scales. And so at least the ground state. I mean, and so so in some sense, I mean, this, as I say, the symmetry breaking is kind, you know, it's really a classical concept. So so I think if one is interested in, you know, just, you know, pushing aside everything except the quantum mechanics and, you know, asking what is really the essence of the quantum mechanics, it's this non-local entanglement, and then asking, you know, how much long-range entanglement can you get and what kind of long-range entanglement can you get, are questions which, you know, I think have only been, you know, started to be asked and answered in the last 5 or 10 years. So I think it's, you know, there's a lot, you know, a lot of work to be done, a lot to be learned still.
I guess I'm asking whether you think it would be worth looking or whether we could hope for something, an analog of an effective field theory that would deal with entanglement, some sort of non-local analog of it, rather than a local order parameter, and that could create a new kind of
paradigm. Okay, so I mean, that's a very good question. I mean, so, I mean, you could ask, you know, what are the sort of field theoretic approaches? Are there any that we can use to describe, for example, spin liquids which have entanglement? And there's something called partons that is used in condensed matter physics where for example, an electron operator or spin operator is written as a product of two fermion operators. And the idea is that those two fermions kind of get a life of their own dynamically, but then there's an emergent gauge field which kind of tries to glue them back together. And actually, I mean, this Gutzwiller wave function I was talking about, I mean, there is an effective field theory, which is actually a gauge theory, which allows one to describe some properties of that spin liquid. So the theories are actually, that seem to be for these spin liquids, are gauge theories rather than, you know, the theories with a global order parameter, and it's precisely because they don't have, you know, local, they don't have local order parameters. There's no global symmetries, so the theories seem to be, you know, that come up then are gauge theories which don't have any symmetry, but nevertheless let you access in a field theoretic representation, you know, dynamics which can be pretty complicated in terms of the original degrees of freedom. I mean, it's
Thanks.
Are there any further questions? Okay, then let's thank the speaker again.